Welcome to Eastern Standard, a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced with the support of 1, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and in this hour, nature. From a new way to join others in getting out into the wilds of Kentucky, and a local perspective on reports of declining insect populations, to finding out why spiders are not only not so bad, they're actually beneficial in a lot of ways, the revival of the American chestnut tree, and last but not least, quilts made of wood. First, we're joined by Laura Burford, Wildlife Program Coordinator for the Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife Resources, and she's been with the agency since the mid-90s, and lately she's been working on a way to get us more involved in protecting and preserving wildlife in Kentucky. Thanks for stopping by, Laura.
Thank you so much.
Help me keep Kentucky wild.
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 Help us keep Kentucky wild.
Help me keep Kentucky wild.
Help me keep Kentucky wild.
Help me keep Kentucky wild.
Fish and Wildlife employees asking us to help them keep Kentucky wild. What are they talking about?
Oh, they are talking about a new program that our agency has just developed. In fact, it's really almost brand new. We launched it on June 1st of last year. And this is a partnership opportunity that we have for folks that are interested in the species of wildlife out there that you might not hunt, fish, or trap. These are the animals like salamanders, songbirds, birds of prey, snakes. These groups make up about 90% of the wildlife species that we have in Kentucky.
And right away, I want to share with our listeners where they can go to find out more about this online. The online web address is?
Yes, it is fw.ky.gov/KY Wild.
Okay. To establish some background on why Kentucky Wild is necessary, I'd like to ask you a little bit about the revenue sources of fish and wildlife, what you depend on to function.
Yes. Well, primarily fish and game agencies are funded from revenues that come from the sale of hunting and fishing licenses. And they're also funded from federal monies, federal excess taxes that are on items that are used for hunting and angling, such as firearms, ammunition, fishing tackle, that sorts of things. And because of that, predominantly fish and game agencies have used the bulk of their monies to in turn then put those back into game restoration projects. You can imagine that's how it is funded, and that's where the priorities of the agencies are, because certainly that's why fish and wildlife agencies came to be in the first place. We do receive some other federal monies through what's called the State Tribal Wildlife Grants Program that allows us to work on some non-game species, and then there are some funds available for threatened and endangered species work. But by and large, when you're talking about a state that has about 1,000 different wildlife species, there's not enough money to go around.
And those excise tax revenues go into a big federal pot that is then distributed to the states under a formula that seeks fairness in the way that it's
Yes, that's correct. That is absolutely correct. It is formula-based. It's based on the number of licenses that a particular state will sell, but it's also based on our population, too. This is our state population, so that's keeping that distribution fair.
So was Kentucky Wild established to raise additional funds that can be used to protect vulnerable species? And it is a nonprofit, is that correct?
The program was established because we do have a team of folks that we have within our agency that work on species that aren't hunted, fished, or trapped. And this is a little different. When people think about fish and wildlife in Kentucky anyway, they're probably thinking about deer and turkey and elk and sport fish and all these wonderful animals that we have, but not thinking about the other. And until Kentucky Wild, the challenge was we didn't really have a good way to partner with people that were interested in those other species. Wouldn't make sense for me to say to you, buy a hunting or fishing license if you're not planning on hunting or fishing. So we didn't have a good way to accept the funding. We built the Kentucky Wild program so folks that want to partner with us in those conservation efforts can do so knowing that the money that they are giving us is going directly to what's called our wildlife diversity program. That's the team I mentioned earlier that works on these species that some people refer to as non-game species.
So this is a membership-driven organization.
It is. This is a part of our agency. It's a program within our agency, but there are are ways in Kentucky Wild that a member can join individually, or someone can just make a donation, or there's also a route for sponsorships. And when we say a sponsorship, we're meaning a business or a corporation that would like to participate by donating directly to what we do.
And so there are various levels of membership.
Yes.
Do the benefits vary according to the level?
They do. As far as the individual membership levels go, they start at $25 and they go all the way up to $1,000. And you can imagine as you increase, different kinds of Kentucky Wildlife gear come with that. It starts off with a field notebook and then it works on up to a bandana, a t-shirt, a tote bag. But what I want to point out with those membership levels is that at each one of them, one of the things we're most excited about is that we offer a chance to be selected to come out in the field with our biologists. We would love to take every single person that signs up for Kentucky Wild out into the field with us, but you can imagine to protect the resource and to keep our number, to keep our folks in the field at a manageable level, we can't always do that. But at each level, starting at 25 all the way up to 1,000, there'll at least be the chance to be selected to go out and do some of the work with us.
What is the State Wildlife Action Plan?
The State Wildlife Action Plan is basically our blueprint for what we are doing. In order to receive any federal funding, Congress requires that each state develop a state wildlife action plan. And what that is, it's developed in conjunction with partners in the states, species experts in the state. And it's basically, again, our blueprint. It what drives what we do. It was first required in 2005, and Kentucky most recently went through ours and comprehensively reviewed it in 2013. And what that does is tells us the state of what our wildlife species are. And that's species that are common all the way up to species that are considered federally endangered or very, very imperiled. And what it does is it gives, again, a snapshot of where these species are. It identifies the threats that species face and specifically what conservation actions can be done to help stabilize or recover the species. Now, in Kentucky, again, our plan was just reviewed in 2013, and we have identified over 300 species that are in greatest conservation need, and it are those species that will receive our attention first.
It seems to me safe to assume that when most people hear fish and wildlife, they're thinking about game, fishing, and hunting. But I understand that you have a team of scientists on staff who are focused entirely on animals that are not hunted, fished, or trapped. What do they do?
Well, that's a very, very good question. We have a group of folks that work at the Center for Mollusk Conservation. That is there in Frankfort, Kentucky, and they are doing not just state work, not just national work. They are internationally renowned for the work that they are doing with freshwater mollusks, freshwater mussels. They are have had some amazing breakthroughs. They are able to rear some of these endangered freshwater mollusks in a laboratory and then restore them into the wild where they haven't been in so many years. And so that work takes a tremendous amount of passion, tremendous amount of investment. They're working there. We also have a team of folks who are in our non-game bird program. They are working with birds of prey, such as bald eagles and peregrine falcons. They're also in the midst of doing a pretty comprehensive survey for barn owls throughout the state. That's a species within our state wildlife action plan that when we first developed that plan, we frankly didn't know how many there were. And now we know of several nesting sites throughout the state, and they are monitoring those to see how successful they are and also to check for contaminants that might be in birds that are recovered here in Kentucky. We have folks that are doing salamander surveys. We have an imperiled species biologist who is doing a lot of work with, well, he's just been involved with a new crayfish species that has been identified in our state. And so we've got a variety of folks that are here. I'm sure I'm leaving some folks out.
Well, what would you say to folks who ask, well, why should I care about the well-being of mollusks or salamanders or crawdads?
It's a valid question. And I think we all have to ask ourselves, you know, how important is a healthy wildlife environment to us? How important is clean water? How important is it that for our generations that come after us, that they'll be able to enjoy wild places that are healthy and balanced and they'll have wildlife to see? All of these things fit together. We can't just take out certain little pieces of the puzzle and put all of our eggs in one basket, for say, like if we want to just protect endangered species or we just want to make sure our game species are healthy. If you just focus on a few, the other pieces that fall away are going to result in a broken system. And so what we want to do is partner with people that would like to see us work on projects that can be more balanced, that if we can restore a watershed, for instance, a river, we're going to benefit a suite of species there. It's not just one or two. But by focusing on habitat-based projects, we think we can do a lot of good.
Okay, we're early in the year. What projects are on your agenda for 2019?
Well, again, we're just about 6 months old with Kentucky Wild, and we are just in the process now of taking some of those funds that have come in, and we're going to purchase some equipment for the upcoming year. One of the projects that we're very, very excited about is some survey work and habitat work for an animal called the Eastern Hellbender, and it is a salamander.
It's a big one, too.
It's a big one. It can get to up to almost 2 feet in length. It's a giant animal. And they like to live in streams that have cool, clear water with very, very large boulders, very, very large rocks. And we know them from about 60 counties in the state. That's where our historic records are from. But we need to follow up on that and make sure that those animals are, in fact, still there. And most importantly, that they're reproducing. They're a fairly long-lived animal as well. And so we want to make sure that their populations haven't been impacted by sedimentation and streams and that sort of thing. And so we're partnering and doing some work with our state neighbor to the north, Indiana, and we will be doing surveys for these hellbender and seeing, again, how healthy their populations are.
Okay, we have just a little bit of time left, and I wanted to be sure to ask you about legislation that's currently before Congress, proposed Recovering America's Wildlife Act. What is that? What would it do?
Yes, the Recovering America's Wildlife Act is currently in a form both before the House and before the Senate. And what this does is a lot like what Kentucky Wild is doing, but on a national level. All the states are facing the same thing. We have species in greatest conservation need in all of our states. We simply don't have enough money to fund those plans, those state wildlife action plans. What this money would do would be to allocate money, in fact, to the tune of $1.3 billion from existing revenue that we have that is generated from energy and mineral exploration on federal lands. So the money is already in the budget. We're asking, this act is asking that it be allocated on an annual basis to each one of the states so they can implement these state wildlife action plans. I've worked for the agency, like you mentioned, from the mid-90s. I have been hoping for something like this for a long, long time because it gives a sustainable, permanent funding source for us for these animals and has bipartisan support. It's very, very exciting. So we're hoping to hear some good news about this legislation this spring.
You seem to enjoy this work.
I enjoy it a lot.
Do you get out in the outdoors a lot?
Oh, I can always say I would like to get out more than I do, but I do. I'm looking forward to the spring season. Our biologists in the non-game program are doing some really exciting things. We're going to be doing some surveys for loggerhead shrike, for salamander surveys, and then again, of course, the hellbender work is pretty exciting.
Laura Burford, she's Wildlife Program Coordinator for the Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife Resources, and we thank you for coming by, Laura.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, reports of major declines in insect populations and why hungry spiders make good house guests.
There's a lot of insects that we don't like that get eaten by spiders, and often we don't even know the spiders are living with us.
Later in the hour, the American chestnut, out to become the comeback kid of the tree world. We'll talk with a scientist who's working to make that happen. And Kentucky Humanities' Bill Goodman visits with an artist who makes quilts out of wood. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the Alltech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Attendees are future thinkers who view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives. They share a belief in the boundless power of just one idea to change everything. The 35th Annual Conference, 119, is May 19th through 21st, 2019, in Lexington. Learn more at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
The headlines are kind of alarming. The New York Times Magazine says the insect apocalypse is here. The Guardian, where have all our insects gone? The Washington Post, hyper-alarming study shows massive insect loss. Scientific American reports that around the globe, scientists are getting hints that all is not well in the world of insects. Reports are trickling in of unsettling changes in populations of not only butterflies and bees, but of all sorts of bugs and beetles. Are we facing insect Armageddon? The study mentioned by the Washington Post found that German nature reserves have seen a 75% reduction in flying insects over the last 27 years, the researchers making stark warnings of a wider collapse of the general insect population that, if left unchecked, would bring about an ecological catastrophe. But is this an over-dramatization of a single study in one country? Or is there some real cause for concern? We thought Tom Myers might be able to shed some light on what's happening as both an entomologist and president of Lexington's All Right Pest Control. He does make a living killing certain kinds of invasive insects, or at least preventing them from procreating. But what sets him apart is that he also travels the world photographing insects, spiders, scorpions, and ticks. He's one of the few who is able to photograph live insects in the wild in their natural habitats. Tom's photos have been exhibited in the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. They've been published in USA Today and National Geographic's Traveler magazine, about 40 publications in all. The fall 2018 issue of American Entomologist had a cover photo by Tom Myers. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Tom.
Thank you.
First, if you would, a quick backgrounder. I understand that you grew up on a farm in southern Indiana and you were interested in bugs as a small boy.
Yes, that's correct. And I love to go out into the fields and see the different insects and collect the insects and observe what they were doing.
So you carried that right on into college and became a board-certified entomologist.
That's correct.
How do you balance being in the business of eliminating insects against a lifelong reverence for them in the wild?
Well, when you're working with insects in any situation, it's important to know the biology and the habits of the insect. And so when I work with them in the wild, you know, trying to find the insect, particularly when I'm photographing the insect, you know, what host plants it feeds on or what locations it frequents are very important. And when I'm working with food plants or distilleries or manufacturing plants where you have an insect in there, it's also important to understand why they have that problem. It's not really just eliminating the insect, but it's eliminating the conditions that are causing that insect to continue to multiply inside that facility. And so you may need to track down the breeding site or the reason that insect is there. And so that's why it's important that I understand the insect as a whole.
That New York Times headline that I mentioned in the introduction, insect apocalypse, is that accurate? Is it hyperbole? What do you think?
It's really hard right now to quantify that, whether it is an exaggeration or not. In too many cases, we don't completely understand the insects and how they relate in the environment. Some cases we do, but sometimes we don't. I know in some of the studies they were talking about a drop in biomass. And is that important or not? We still don't know. In some areas, as in our other worlds, I know in Yellowstone, they did away with the wolves. And you had a big increase in biomass because the elk just went crazy. And so you had big herds and populations of elk. So you picked up the biomass. But by having that, it also destroyed a lot of the plant material, and you're having problems with streams and other things. When they reintroduced the wolves,
you decreased the biomass, but you increased the biodiversity, and the ecosystem became more balanced. And so in some cases, we don't know. I think biodiversity is a lot more important than biomass in a lot of cases.
And it isn't clear yet, and I think the science is saying that. Here's where they seem to be. The stats that I've been able to gather say that scientists here in this country have determined that the population of monarch butterflies, for example, that we all love to see,
right?
That population has fallen by 90% in the last 20 years. The pollinator, the rusty patched bumblebee, down 87% over that same period. Flying insects in German nature reserves have decreased by 75% over 27 years. In Britain, as many as 60% of species have diminishing ranges, and that would get into the development question, mm-hmm. I guess.
Right.
Scientists looking into the causes of these declines cite the spread of monoculture farms or the steady growth of developed areas such as cities and roads. Are you seeing that as well? Are you seeing examples of this kind of encroachment?
Yeah, I think the monoculture does have a lot to do with it. Where I collected it when I was young, you go back to that area, and now it's a subdivision. And you know, when you have monoculture, have vast fields of soybeans or corn or even bluegrass and fescue in our yards, you're really just giving a desert to these insects where they can't really survive. You're selecting for certain insects, sure, especially the ones that are happen to be pests on your lawn or pests of the corn or soybeans. But you're getting away from the biodiversity of the plants that were in that area, so you're cutting back the biodiversity of the insects. So habitat loss has a lot to do with that. And of course, for the most part, we're the cause.
We kind of have this swatting, stomping, impatient, sometimes even phobic relationship with most bugs, it seems. After all, we do refer to certain species, certainly termites, as pests.
Right.
But when they bother us or they do real damage to our homes or our businesses, we call a control company like yours to come in and help us get rid of them.
Right.
What would you say to people about what's going on in the world with the loss of insect populations versus their concern about cohabitating with them in the world?
Well, I think for the most part, we're going to have to try to cohabitate with insects because they're very important in our environment. And, you know, 98% or so of insects are of no problem. But it's that small percentage of insects that are a problem, a lot that I deal with in my business, you know, the cockroaches and the bed bugs and Indian meal moths or stored grain products that get into your cupboards, that I deal with. And we have insects that do spread disease, and we have to deal with those things. Either that or we're going to, you know, lose a lot of people to different types of diseases.
Chemical pollution in particular, pollution in general, and human growth and development, as we've said, might be cited as factors. But also, what about climate change?
I think climate change does have an effect. We see that in a lot of times in insects. We notice that even in the spreads of diseases, we have seen malaria in certain areas of Africa, which was never there before, particularly because of the temperatures, especially in altitudes. The organism inside the mosquito couldn't survive at above certain altitudes because of the temperature. But as we get climate change, the altitude that the organisms can survive goes higher, so you're getting malaria at higher altitudes than you did before.
Tom, why should we care about what we've been talking about here, about these declines in insect populations?
Well, we should care because insects are just a very important part of the ecosystem as a whole. If all the insects were gone, the ecosystem would collapse, which would cause the demise of the human population too. Insects are really needed to keep things going in this earth, whether they're pollinators, whether they get rid of debris or dead animals or whatever else. I mean, they're really important part of this whole planet working.
Is there anything that I haven't touched on here that this conversation has sparked in your mind that we ought to include?
Like we're saying, we are causing a lot of the problems by our monoculture, or that we're clearing vast areas of land, and we need some of those areas, of course, to produce enough food. But there's also a lot of areas, that, and especially in the United States, that we waste We can think of our yards for one thing. We just plant all this grass and we think it's great. Well, we get a few weeds in there, we want to get rid of them. Or you have a dandelion come up here, we want to get rid of it. We want to have that monoculture of grass, beautiful green grass out there. And I think that one thing we could do is start planting a lot of native plants into these areas that they could survive in, that could help out the insects and help out the biodiversity. I realize that a lot of cities have these rules about what you should have in your front yard, and that's probably, for the most part, very silly. We should embrace the planting of native plants in our yards to allow more insects. And the same thing we have along roadsides and interstates. We have vast, vast areas that are just grass. When we mow them on a regular basis, we have some areas they've tried to introduce native plants or wildflowers, etc., but not on a whole scale. Talking about the monarchs, where they have, a lot of it is loss of food, which is the milkweed that they eat. There's no real reason we couldn't plant milkweed all along our interstates and make a great corridor for monarchs back and forth from Mexico, where they overwinter.
And the milkweed is pretty ubiquitous. It grows everywhere, right?
Yes, it does. We used to have a lot of monarchs because the way we would raise our crops in the past is we would have a lot of fence rows. And so you'd have fence rows that had some of the trees in it. You had some milkweed growing there. We had wildflowers and other things that grew in these fence rows. And then plus we planted crops, and you would have milkweed growing up through the crops. But then when we started having Roundup-ready crops where you could spray, where you develop crops are resistant to Roundup, and you could spray and kill all that milkweed in the field, and we had bigger equipment and wanted to have bigger farms, and we would tear out all these fence rows and just plant from here to the horizon with one type of plant, then we eliminated a lot of the biodiversity and also the food for the milkweed and also harborage for other insects. So it's just the way we have advanced as a society. I mean, we can see all the pavement we have, all the concrete we have. There's nothing growing there.
Tom Myers is an entomologist, a photographer of insects in the wild, and he is the president of All Right Pest Control Company in Lexington. Thank you for joining us, Tom.
Thank you.
Transylvania University biologist James Wagner studies spiders, and he has appeared on a Discover Magazine segment of the Discovery Channel and an episode of Weird, True, and Freaky on Animal Planet. Dr. Wagner was named the 2001 Kentucky Professor of the Year by the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching and the Council for Advancement and Support of Education. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Wagner.
Thank you for inviting me.
And first, if you tell us a bit about the focus of your research on spiders.
Well, originally I got interested in how spider populations change over a year, and I studied a wolf spider that's common here in Kentucky and also in Maryland and the eastern seaboard. And what I was intrigued with is that in the summertime, there's about 2 adult females per meter square in the forest floor. These spiders don't make webs. They run around and grab prey on the foot. And over the year, they would reproduce, and each female would produce about 45 spiderlings. That's what you call baby spiders, spiderlings. Hmm. And so the population would explode to about 90 spiders per meter squared, but it would quickly decline down to 2 adult females by the following summer. And I was intrigued by what drove those decline in numbers. And my research showed that it was mostly cannibalism. The spiders were eating each other.
They eat their young.
Yeah, well, actually, no, it's the young eating each other, brothers and sisters, sibs, or wow, non-related individuals. Once the spiderlings get dispersed into the leaf litter, they are size-selective predators. They eat whatever that they can subdue, and so often it was another spiderling.
That is the ultimate in sibling rivalry.
Yes, it is.
This is going to be a generalization, but we humans tend to dislike spiders.
Yes.
Some of us even live in mortal fear of them. Is this reasonable, or do we need to become more discerning in our choices of which spiders to like versus which ones to loathe?
Well, there's over 40,000 described species of spiders in the world, and some estimate there's probably 4 times that have not been described. So there's a lot of spider species in the world, and there's only a few
that actually are of medical importance to humans. That is, that if they bite you, there is a possibility that you would have a health reaction to it. Obviously, the two we're familiar with is the brown recluse and the black widow. But to be honest with you, the risk of you getting bit by those spiders and actually having any kind of medical effect is pretty slim to none. There's been reviews of doctor cases where they've reported spider bites. And I think the one I was looking at recently, they reviewed 216 cases of spider bites. And they basically said most of those spider bite reportings were in locations where the brown recluse did not even exist, like in Alaska. So doctors often misdiagnose skin lesions and blame it on a spider bite, which I think encourages people to feel the risk is greater than it really is.
Is it true, in fact, that if left alone, left to their own devices, spiders will actually consume most of the insects in your house and actually provide some pest control?
Yes, for sure. A lot of the spiders, of course, use webs to capture prey, and that we find that very unsettling to have cobwebs around our house. But there are a few spiders that live in our houses that don't use webs to capture prey. They're called sack spiders. You might have noticed them up in the corner of your ceiling and wall. There'll be a little silken retreat built there, and these little sack spiders will come out at night and feed on mosquitoes that might be hiding on the ceiling and other insects. So yes, you're correct. There's a lot of insects that we don't like that get eaten by spiders, and often we don't even know the spiders are living with us.
How about in farming and agriculture? Are spiders somehow beneficial?
Oh,
you know, we think of bees, for example.
Right, for sure. We don't appreciate the value that spiders have in sort of controlling pests in agricultural system. There's been some beautiful studies showing that just putting, say, straw thatch down in your garden, that increases the habitat for wolf spiders and other kinds of spiders that then come into and go up into the vegetation at night and eat the pests that feed on your crops. And that idea has been extended to agricultural systems. So yeah, there's been a lot of interesting studies showing the value of spiders as a part of an integrated pest management program.
Dr. Wagner, what is your favorite spider story?
Favorite spider story? I think the one that I often think about is the story that many people know or have heard, that over a year, you swallow 8 spiders in your sleep, unbeknownst to you as you're sleeping. And that story, people have asked me about that. And the original story, surprisingly, was created in 1993 by a technology writer. And she added it to her email as a list of facts to try to show that people accept crazy ideas just because they read about it on the internet. And so in her effort to show how gullible we can be, it has now become sort of people's idea of what really happens. But no, you do not swallow spiders in your sleep.
So it turns out the original fake news had to do with spiders.
Yes, yes.
Transylvania University biologist James Wagner, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Spider-Man, Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can.
Coming up after the break, why does it matter that scientists like EKU's Jennifer Coslow are working to bring back the American chestnut tree?
We're looking at a model now of a really audacious project. I mean, the American Chestnut Foundation wants to bring a species back from the brink of extinction.
And an artist who fashions quilts from wood?
The process is very interesting. I collect the wood, so I'm usually dumpster diving, or I've picked it up along the side of the road.
All ahead on Eastern Standard. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to WEKU.
Wherever there's a hang-up, you'll find a Spider-Man.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the Alltech Ideas Conference. One is an incubator of innovation, a forum for future thinkers, and a platform for propelling forward the promise of a planet of plenty. Attendees view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives in order to make a difference in the world. Learn more about One 19 in Lexington, May 19th through the 21st, 2019, at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Something else has gone missing from our natural world, the once mighty and abundant, at one time, American chestnut tree. The American chestnut used to make up about a quarter of the hardwood forest in the eastern USA. Their nuts kept wildlife thriving all winter and played a large part in the economy of places like Appalachia. Today, from Maine down to Alabama and Louisiana, the trees are all but gone. But not if Jennifer Coslow has anything to do with it. As an associate professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at EKU, Dr. Coslow is focused on the ecology and evolution of infectious disease and rare plant conservation, and is also focused on the revival of the American chestnut. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Coslow.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And first, if you would, help us get a mental image of this tree that we're talking about in its full-grown glory, the American chestnut.
Well, estimates vary as to exactly how tall and how wide they could get, but it has been described as the redwood of the East. So some estimates include trees as large as 100 feet tall and many feet wide, although, of course, I would throw in there that many other species that are still around today used to be much larger before they were clear-cut.
And did they have a bloom?
They do. So they have very small specialized flowers that you would see in other members of that botanical family. But in this case, the small flowers create a spray, basically, of catkins. So you can actually see a bunch of white flowers, but you don't necessarily know that's what they are, although you can often smell them.
Beyond its connection to the ecology, and we'll get to that in just a minute, of the forest. What were some of the uses by man of the American chestnut tree?
The American chestnut has been described as a rural or a country tree, and that's part of why it had such a big influence for people in Appalachia, because it would provide nuts for people to eat. So people would literally collect the nuts, bring them in bags, and have them shipped off to eastern cities once the railroad lines were in place. They could use them to barter or get scrip at different stores. So not only would they eat them themselves, but almost trade them as currency. But also the wood itself was a very versatile wood, not the most beautiful wood to look at in terms of making furniture, but very strong, lightweight, and rot resistant. So people would build cabins, cradles, fences, coffins. They would put furniture together with it and then put a prettier veneer over it. It also, the wood contains a lot of tannin, and so people would also extract that tannin to tan leather. So that was a big industry for a while.
I think when we think of the nuts, we think of the song Roasting Over an Open Fire, which was a real thing at one time.
Absolutely.
Bring us up to date, if you would, then, on the status of the American chestnut now.
Well, the status of the American chestnut now, we're trying to be in a hopeful place, but truthfully, in 1904 in New York City, they discovered a blight, and that blight ended up spreading throughout the entire range of chestnuts. And that blight took these towering, magnificent trees and turned them into, I guess you would think that they look maybe like very small trees or even shrub-like, because the large stems would die off, and then the tree is known that it tends to resprout from the roots. So new sprouts are still coming up. You can still see American chestnuts in forests today, but they're very small, and it's all because of this blight. So that blight came from probably China, and it probably came because chestnut fanciers also enjoyed different chestnut species from around the world. So they imported chestnut trees from Europe and Japan and China, and other places, and probably on one or more of those trees came with it accidentally this, what we would definitely call an invasive species, this blight.
Some sort of fungus, perhaps?
It is a fungal species, mm-hmm. Yep.
And it was pretty devastating to the species.
Extremely
in
devastating.
In a short amount of time?
Very short amount of time. Although one wonders, at one point, because it was such an important tree commercially, at one point the directive was given, well, the blight's coming, so cut your losses, literally cut the trees down. And so to some extent we think now that that contributed to some of the loss, because as an evolutionary biologist, one of the things that's fascinating about organisms is how much variation they have. So maybe there could have been more extremely rare, but individuals that would have been naturally resistant. And there are very rare ones that still exist now. There's a famous one in Adair County, Kentucky, that's just a big open grown tree that seems to be thriving.
Do they adapt to fend off something like an invasive fungus?
The American chestnuts really don't have any opportunity to adapt, because one of the things that occurred when they were converted from being these towering trees into little shrubs is that these smaller trees or shrubs never become mature enough to create flowers and then reproduce. And so they're what we would call functionally extinct. Evolution can't really occur because there's no more new offspring being created.
So you are part of an effort now to bring back this tree. What are you doing?
It's interesting for me as a scientist to be so involved in this, mostly as service and education, even though it touches, I mean, I first learned about this situation from my research as an example of what kind of influences pathogens can have in a forest. And it's just this amazing but terrible example. What I'm really doing is working in partnership and as a part of the Kentucky chapter of the American Chestnut Foundation. The American Chestnut Foundation functions, it has a national office, has chapters in every state that once had native chestnuts. And so their large endeavor has been using what you might call a breeding program, but they started noticing at really early on that these Chinese chestnuts weren't getting the blight. And so what they did initially, and they're still working on, is they would take an American chestnut, which is this tall tree with a lot of grandeur, but susceptible to the blight, and then cross it with chestnuts from China, which have resistance to the blight, but have different characteristics that mostly only a botanist would notice, but also characteristics such as just being a shorter, more multi-stem tree just by nature, no matter how old it is. And what they do after that is they take the offspring from that hybrid cross, and then they grow those up, and the ones that survive the blight and the ones that look the most like American chestnuts continue on breeding, and they'll breed those with pure American chestnuts again. And so they've been doing this. We're at several generations now. And so we have trees on Eastern's campus that are a result of this program, and they are 1/16th Chinese chestnut and 15/16th American chestnut.
And how are they doing?
Well, they are doing, some of them are doing very, very well. Others of them are having a little harder time. They were a result of an experiment. One of the things that the American Chestnut Foundation does is purposefully introduces virulent forms of, aggressive forms of the blight. Because they want to be sure that the trees that they spend so much time growing and breeding and carting around and tending for are actually going to be useful for their restoration program.
The American Chestnut Foundation is online. There's a website. I've seen that. And there's a Kentucky chapter. Somebody's driving down the road right now listening to us and thinking, why do I care about an American chestnut tree? What would you say to them?
Well, I guess I would say maybe you don't care about an American chestnut. If you grew up in Appalachia, I guarantee you your grandparents did. But if you personally don't care about that species in particular, I would say to you, that's fine, but we're looking at a model now of a really audacious project. I mean, the American Chestnut Foundation wants to bring a species back from the brink of extinction, and that species stretches from Maine to Alabama and possibly further. And that loss of that species had a big impact on our forests. But if we can bring a species back, we have a model for how we might be able to bring other species back. And this is not the only tree species that has suffered from invasive pests. I mean, just right now, we're dealing with hemlock woolly adelgid. We're dealing with, I'm sure people driving down the road are able to see the ash trees that are all standing dead from the emerald ash borer. And those are just two prominent examples. People in California are all worried about the root rot that they have there. So there's a lot of pathogens going around, and those are, I guess I could list more, but having a group of people committed to trying to bring a species back is a way to feel hopeful despite all the destruction that we see.
How can people find out more about what you're doing locally?
In addition to finding just the American Chestnut Foundation and then the Kentucky Chapter's webpage, which you could easily find through a Google search, you can follow the Kentucky Chapter through Facebook pages. So you can like us on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Instagram.
Dr. Jennifer Coslow is an associate professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at Eastern Kentucky University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Underneath the spreading chestnut tree, I loved him and he loved me. There I used to sit up.
All that tree talk brings to mind wood and the many things you can do with it. Kentucky Humanities' Bill Goodman looks at one of the more unique uses for wood that we've ever heard of.
Think for a moment about a piece of wood that you might find on the side of the road, or a plank from an old, weather-worn Kentucky barn that you discover on a long-abandoned tobacco farm. Maybe your search leads you to a window frame left over from the demolition of a neighborhood house. To you, it's just wood. To Laura Petrovich Cheney, it's just wood, until she creates a work of art, turning salvaged wood into a patchwork quilt. A wooden quilt that brings meaning and order to her creation. Going against the grain, Wooden Quilts is on display at Berea College's Doris Ullman's Upper Trailer Gallery. Petrovich Cheney's work will be at the gallery until February 15th. Her wooden quilts were once clapboard siding, floorboards, and kitchen cabinets.
It all started after a pretty bad nor'easter storm. And when I found two boats on the beach and I brought them home and I thought, this is kind of interesting. I started making quilts out of the boats, but the boats were small. And so I was running out of wood. And then that summer, it was the summer of 2013, I was having a grand old time making these. And as I said before, I was running out of wood. Now, October comes along, and we are hit with Hurricane Sandy at the end, right around Halloween. And I go out to get a cup of coffee. We have no electricity, no power. And I'm driving around, and I'm running into a dresser, a screen door, siding that had fallen off. And I thought, what is all this? Is such a huge disaster. What is all this wood? And then I realized, like, oh, my goodness, I can take all this wood and make quilts out of it. And it came at such an opportune time because, as I mentioned, I was running out of the boat wood and needed more wood. But then this work of collecting people's remnants of their houses after the storm took on meaning. And it was really important because we all were faced with such a huge disaster of Hurricane Sandy, just as I'm sure everybody has seen tornadoes or earthquakes and hurricanes and just how it ruins people's lives. And so what I started to do is take, you know, a dresser from the neighbor up the street or clapboard siding from my parents' house or, you know, a screen door from someone else's and piece it together in hopes of taking a little bit of everybody's lives and making order back out of that chaos. It was serendipity that I got this idea. I actually saw a magazine in a grocery store, and I was flipping through it and was decorating your house with quilts. And that's what kind of gave me that idea. I thought, wow, I could take all the wood I've collected and turn it into quilts. So it was just really, it was luck and chance that the idea came to me.
Petrovich Cheney says material has memory, that the objects which surround us offer comfort and identity and become carriers of our stories.
The process is very interesting. I collect the wood, so usually dumpster diving, or I've picked it up along the side of the road. And so they're really large pieces when they first come to me. And what I mean by large is, you know, they're 8 feet by 4 feet. Sometimes they're panels. And I cut them down small on using a Sawzall. I then cut them smaller on a miter saw, and then again on a bandsaw, and it just keeps getting smaller and smaller. So if you can imagine bolts of fabric being cut down to a yard, to a half yard, to a 2x2 inch square, that's exactly what I do with the wood. And once I cut it to the shape that I need it, I sand it, and then I glue it onto another backing. And then from there, I make the patterns.
Recently, the artist has begun to collect wood from other parts of the country that have suffered environmental disasters.
It started when I saw the Gatlinburg, Tennessee fires in 2017, and they had resonated so much with me. People had lost so much, and it came so quickly and so unexpectedly, and they had no time to prepare. And I had known the curator there, and she invited me down to come and collect wood from those fires. There wasn't much to collect. Obviously, a fire destroys wood, but there was some pieces left. And what made that interesting for me was it doesn't matter what the disaster was or who you are or what your economic standings are or your race or religion. When you suffer a loss, it's a great equalizer. And so for me, it just brings communities together, and you have such empathy for someone who's lost so much when you've experienced that yourself. So for me to collect from other disasters is finding common ground, you know, to say, I've been through this, I understand what you're going through. And sometimes that's all you want to hear when everything's in your life has been destroyed.
Laura Petrovich Cheney's wooden quilts will be on display at the Doris Ullman Gallery at Berea College through February 15th. For Eastern Standard and Kentucky Humanities, this is Bill Goodman.
Well, that wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced in the Lexington studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of 1. The All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. Information about Eastern Standard content partnerships can be found online at esweku.com. Now you can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on the WEKU mobile app for iPhone and Android devices. Download the free app in the Apple Store or Google Play. Eastern Standard's also available as a podcast. You'll find us on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.